Dr. Jim Avery, we're very fortunate to have him tonight. Just a couple of thoughts about words about him, and a couple of my own personal thoughts. He graduated with high honors, Phi Beta Kappa from Stony Brook. And from there, he went to medical school at the University of South Florida, Chicago at Northwestern for residency in internal medicine. Then moved to the Tampa, Florida area, where he did a pulmonary and critical care fellowship and set up practice there. He was in private practice there in Clearwater, Florida for 14 years. From there, Jim went to be the senior medical director for the Hospice of the Florida Suncoast, which is the biggest hospice program in the country, and had some interesting experiences there for those 4 years. And about a year ago, he and his family moved back up to this area, and he is now the senior medical director of the Visiting Nurse Service of New York Hospice Care Program. He's board certified in hospice and palliative medicine, internal medicine, and pulmonary medicine. And he is also married to his lifelong sweetheart, Jan, for 23 years. They have three kids. They all their names begin with the letter J. Jonathan, Joseph, and Julie. And Joseph, or Joe, is in the back. He's in school here in the city. And Joe's going to medical school. Is that right? Joe's here. John's going to medical school. Is that right? Okay. Jim Avery loves teaching, hates paperwork. I agree with that. Amen. And loves walking. He loves walking so much that he walked up Mount Kilimanjaro 6 years ago, which is pretty impressive. And he must have good lungs to get up there. Just a couple of more things about Jim. He's published several articles, including several articles and papers about hospice care and end-of-life issues. And on a personal note, I just want to add that I think we're all in for a really good treat. I've heard Jim speak before, and he's a really great speaker. But more importantly, he's got a great passion and compassion for tough issues. And he's the kind of doctor I certainly would want to have caring for me if I were gravely ill and needing more than just technical care. As you all know in the health fields, and those of you who are just experienced doctors, it is difficult to find a doctor you can talk to who speaks human languages and somebody you really can open up to and relate to. And Jim is really, honestly, one of these people. And I think that we're in for a real treat. So, Jim Avery.
Does everyone have a handout? Anybody need one? Now, we're going to have fun, so this is going to be informal. You can interrupt me. I'm getting over a cold, so if my voice gives out, that will be a clue for discussion time. So just if that happens, let me know. And then someone's going to be doing the slides. Okay. This life and death talk, the topic was sort of determined by Tim, but I think it's an issue where it will intersect everybody, regardless of young, old, healthy, ill. And I think you're going to see how, I hope you'll see as I go along my passion, why I do hospice medicine. One thing you may want to ask yourself, why would a physician want to do hospice? Why deal with only patients who have less than 6 months of life left? I mean, does that make any sense? It doesn't even sound reasonable. But hopefully, as you go along, I think you'll see that what we can learn from our patients who have lived their life, and then what the things that I've learned. I started out with this one by Leo Tolstoy, The Death of Ivan Ilyich, because it sort of integrates, I think, where we are. Some of us here are healthcare workers. Some are pastors. And in this part of the novel, now everybody should read this thing. It's 90 pages. You can knock it off on a Sunday afternoon, you know, laying in Central Park. And at this point in the novel, the guy has cancer. His name is Ivan Ilyich. He has cancer. Doctor comes and makes a home visit, like I do. Gives him a shot of morphine and says, Ivan, there's nothing more I can do for you. Doctor leaves. Ivan looks at his wife and says, I will tell him, the doctor, that he must think of something else. It's impossible to go on like this. So when you're reading the novel, you think, oh, the poor guy's got this cancer pain. What a shame, you know. And as a physician, I'm thinking, well, give him more morphine. What's the problem here? But what you find out is that his suffering, this impossible to go on, had very little to do with his cancer pain. What it had to do with of a life that was poorly lived. He has spent his life trying to be a judge. So he works, and he works, and he works. He's not close with his wife. He's not close with his kids. And he's looking back on his life, and he's thinking, this is unbearable. And now I'm dying. And that's where this issue, I think, touches all of us. That when we talk about dying, we're talking about living. And that the intersection here is between life and death, between sickness and health, between everything that we're doing. And I think as we get our priorities correct about how we view death, life sort of falls into place in many ways. And I think it's very interesting for me, who did hospice in Florida for so many years, to now find that in New York, a sophisticated, well-developed city, more people deny death here than anywhere I've been before. So we'll talk about that. Next slide. Daniel Salmasi wrote a great book. And in this book, The Healer's Calling, he talks about suffering. And he tries to tell us in this quick quote that it has more to do than just physical things. In other words, it's less to do with pain fibers and more to do with suffering, the mystery of being human. So my thesis from the beginning is everybody suffers. We suffer from living in this world. Disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes, diseases, illness. We suffer from living with others, and then from living with oneself. Now, we know that. But let me tell you, I was making a home visit the other day, and it's this big apartment just up from the American Museum of Natural History. And this guy has cancer, so I go in. I've never been in this apartment before. You go in, there's a doorman. You don't even like the revolving doors. He turns it for you. You don't even have to touch the door, you know? And then you get in, and, you know, where are you going? And it was raining that day, and he's brushing off my coat, and he takes my umbrella. And then it's to the, I forget what floor it was, but say the 7th floor. So I go to the elevator, and there's an elevator man. So he lets me in, brings me up, and when you get to the 7th floor, there's no other apartments. This is a private elevator. And you know what I thought as I entered that apartment? I'm thinking, in myself, knowing what I just told you, is this guy suffering? Because you start thinking, with all the creature comforts, with all the people he has serving him, is he suffering? So I go in the apartment, and the guy has prostate cancer. And he made his money in diamonds. Very wealthy. And he had a two-story, there was a stairway overlooking Central Park. This incredible windows, and everything was just to the max. And the sad thing was, he had a caregiver, and he had a nurse. And then, well, where's his wife? And the caregiver tells me his wife is in Paris with her boyfriend. And he whispers that to me on the side. And here this guy was alone. Unbelievable suffering. The same exact day, hours later, I go up to Washington Heights. And I'm in one of these elevators. It's a two-person elevator. Now, if you've seen these little tiny elevators, you go in there. And you get on this narrow hallway. And I open this door. And here's another guy who's very poor. Who's also dying of cancer. I'm making a home visit to see him. He has his family all around, grandchildren all around. He's having good pain management. It's a crowded place, but people are there. Everyone's there, and this guy was wealthy, and he was rich. Yet before I entered each place, I thought it would be the opposite. We so often forget that most of our suffering comes from the things that we are, that who we are. And in that light, I wanted to define suffering in a different way, not from the usual suffering, but to prove to you, I hope, that everyone suffers. So I'm viewing it, suffering, as an experience of finitude. That's too abstract. I mean, you know, who knows what that means? But I think you'll understand what I'm talking about here. First of all, that human beings are oriented towards the truth. We want to be truthful. We want to be with people who are truthful. We want people to be truthful for us, right? But we're prone to lie, we're prone to cheat, we're prone to exaggerate so often. We have this sense of suffering. We're oriented towards the good. We want things that are good. We want good things for our kids. But we're plagued by all these things that are bad and our own choices that often will be hatred or bigotry or selfishness. Or oriented towards the beautiful. Yet we know we're getting older, we're getting wrinkled, we're getting marks, we're limping now. And we know that we do things that are ugly and disfigure others. And we want freedom. And yet we're constrained, and we enslave others, and we control others. And we do all these things that are the opposite of what we're reaching for. Blaise Pascal talks about, I just finished reading his book, Pens Panses. And he emphasizes constantly the dualism of human beings. That we're this divine creature, in a sense, reaching towards God. And yet at the same time, we're often like animals, reaching even lower. And that's that source of suffering. And even if everything goes well, my premise to you is that you're still, suffering is a part of the human process. So having said that, then you have to say, well, where does suffering fit into healthcare? Now, if you start off by saying, if suffering has no spiritual meaning, then there can be no spirituality of healthcare. It's just by definition. But that can't be, in a sense, because we know the medical profession, a secular profession, is now saying we need this badly. Right now in medical schools, 38% of all medical schools are teaching medical students how to do a spiritual history. Okay? 2% of the family practice boards are on spiritual questions. In other words, what they're saying is we missed something here. That we should have been doing this, in a sense. And now we realize there has to be some degree of struggling. And you may have questions about this. I see some puzzled looks. We're going to get to that more. And you can ask questions during, but we'll have questions and answer after also. So, my premise for you is this, that there's an illusion in modern medicine that you can separate the treatment of disease from the person, that you can separate the treatment of disease from the suffering. Again, abstract. Let me tell you where that leads us next. What I call the deconstruction of suffering. Now, if you construct a house, what do? Get the lumber, get the bricks, put it together. If you deconstruct something, you take it apart. I would propose to you that medicine has deconstructed the human being. Only physical pain is real. When I was in medical school, in OB, when you go on your obstetrics rotation, it's a lot of fun. And the first week was a lot of fun. You know, all you needed was a catcher's mitt and hand out cigars. And then the second week, first patient, a patient came in with a full-term baby that was dead. Now she has to go through full labor and deliver this dead baby. And I'm a medical student, and I'm standing in the corner. You know, medical students don't want to contaminate anybody, so you stand like if you don't touch anything or do anything. And I'm standing in the corner, and this room was a place of horrible suffering. Terrible suffering. And I'm thinking to myself, why is that? Same vaginal canal, same bones that have to stretch, same muscles. Why is this such a place of terrible suffering? I'm thinking, of course, of only physical pain. What about the spiritual pain? What about the emotional pain? What about the psychological pain? And so the illusion in medicine is we deconstruct things and we say only physical pain is real. Number two, in the medical profession, we sometimes devaluate a patient's personhood. For those not in the medical profession, it's not uncommon for interns and residents and physicians to talk about the gallbladder in room 367. Or the heart attack in CCU bed 2. It's not meant derogatory. You can't remember people's names and you're thinking, but in a sense, we do start to think of people as their disease. And I'll show you that a little bit later. The third one is loss of empathic communication skills. We have some of the best hospitals in the country right here in our city. They send people home and then I go to the home and visit. And you know, so often doctors will tell people, like they did in Leo Tolstoy's book, there's nothing more I can do for you. Now, think about that for a second. Just think about it from a purely intellectual standpoint. Is there ever a point where we can't do anything more for somebody? In other words, what I say quite frequently is I can't do anything more for your lung cancer, but I can do a lot for you as a person. I can't do anything more for your heart disease, but I can do a lot for you as an individual. But if someone says they can't do anything more for you, aren't they intellectually, again, thinking of you as a disease? As a heart, as a lung cancer itself. There's no validity to that statement. And so what patients often say is that their physicians maybe have dismissed them, or they don't want to see me anymore because there's nothing more they can do. So what Cicely Saunders said, who was the founder of Modern Day Hospice in 1967, she was a born-again believer who founded hospice. She was interesting. She was a social worker who then became a nurse, who then became a physician. And then she said, I want to take care of people in a whole person way in London, England. And she felt no one would let her. She had obstacles, people put things in her way. So she finally said, well, look, give me the patients no one else wants. And who were those? The dying. And that was the first hospice, 1967, St. Christopher's Hospice, a born-again believer who says, I want to do whole person medicine. And she said, look, if we're going to treat pain, we have to redefine this thing because we're not thinking of it properly. She goes, we want to treat suffering. That's the goal of the healthcare profession. That's the goal of all, each one of us is going to be my premise for you. And so if we want to do that, we have to define suffering as physical pain, plus social pain, plus psychological pain, plus spiritual pain, draw a line, edit up that suffering. Now, what does that mean? That means that each one of you is suffering to a certain extent right now. I don't know. Some of you may have an illness. Some of you may be alienated from family, have social pain. Some of you may have some psychological or emotional pain. Some of you may have some spiritual pain, some spiritual angst. And if we add that up in each person, we can say that's their total suffering. That's their total pain. Now, Cicely Saunders said, well, we have to treat those pains. Just that if you don't know how hospice works, hospice was arranged around those four dimensions. Every patient who gets hospice gets a physician, a nurse, a social worker, and a chaplain based on those four dimensions. That we need to treat all those dimensions for those that are dying if we're going to treat suffering. Well, let's go through these for a second. Social pain. I was making a visit up in one of the projects. And I get to the front door, and the door has no glass and no screen. This is last summer. It's been kicked in, okay? And there's the patient right there. And I'm asked to see her by our hospice nurse. She had cancer, but she had increasing abdominal pain, and she had lung cancer. So it's 9:30 in the morning, and I'm examining her, and her pain didn't make any sense from a medical standpoint. I couldn't figure out where this pain was coming from. And just then, her son comes in on his bicycle, and he lives there. And alcohol in his breath, and you could feel the tension in the room increase. And so I transferred her to our hospice house. Do you know within a week we could cut her morphine in half? You see, what was the source of her suffering? A difficult living situation. That was the source. Psychological pain. We had a patient when I was down in Florida. She was 9 years old, had histiocytosis X, a very painful bone disorder. And our pediatric hospice doctor was seeing her, and they had her on very high doses of OxyContin. If you're familiar with medicine, for those medically inclined, she was on 1,100 milligrams of OxyContin every 8 hours. That's probably enough to wipe out this side of the room. You know, it's that high a dose, but she was in a lot of pain. And he came to me and said, you know, Jim, I'm uncomfortable with these doses. What do you recommend? I said, well, you know, you can try a pump. I go, you can try some steroids. And I gave him a whole bunch of possible things to try to relieve her pain. So I see him about a month later. I go, Bob, how's that little girl doing? He goes, Jim, we were able to cut her OxyContin dose down by 75%. I go, what'd you do? He goes, we got her a puppy. And I go, a puppy? And I'm thinking it's a medical device. So I go, Bob, a puppy? I go, what's a puppy? And he goes, Jim, you know, a little dog. But the point is, if we could treat her depression, if we could treat her anxiety, we could treat her pain, her suffering, her total suffering. Now, for those spiritually minded, and for those who are here and thinking of biblical things, and who are like psychology, I'll tell you about the last two here. When I was in private practice for 14 years, when people came in stressed out, what stressed them out? Their wife, their husband, their kids, their finances, their job. In other words, the things people were doing to them. And then I start doing hospice. And my first week or so, I'm doing hospice, and I'm seeing this guy, and he says, Dr. Avery, I've got to tell you something. I had an affair 10 years ago. And I'm thinking, why is he telling me this? No one ever told me stuff like this. And then I make another visit, and someone else would be telling me stuff. And what I found was, and no one's published this, by the way, and it should be published, so if you're interested, do this study. What I have found, without a doubt, and other people confirm it once I say, have you guys noticed this doing hospice work? What happens is that people at the end of their life, what bothers them is not what they did to others. Not what others did to them, but what they did to others. Wounds inflicted start to come back in a very, and it's not just in those who are religious or have guilt, it seems to be universal. I make home visits from Chinatown to the Upper East Side, up to Washington Heights, and it seems to transcend cultures, transcend religious backgrounds. In a study of cardiology patients, if you did the psychosocial stuff after people had a heart attack, you could reduce the second heart attack by as much as 75%, meaning treat the depression, deal with the anxiety, deal with the stuff that's going on, and you could reduce second heart attacks. That's a greater intervention than anything except quitting smoking. Now, I was getting to talk to nurses, and I didn't know any nurses, you know, famous nurses, except Florence Nightingale and Clara Barton, you know. So I went on the internet and looked up Florence Nightingale for this talk, and I came across this quote. And look at this. In 1859, the patient's sufferings are often not the symptoms of disease, but other things, which is what I'm telling you today, that most of the suffering that I see in my patients is not the disease. It's often from other things. And most of the suffering that most of us go through, in fact, the physical stuff is easy to treat in a way. Next. Then there's the spiritual pains, that my life is over, that my life didn't have meaning, that I have no hope, and we'll talk more about hope. Unresolved guilt, terror of the afterlife, burdens of sins, or that God has abandoned me. You know, if you ever visit a patient or you have family members and they're asking why questions, why questions by almost definition are spiritual. They're asking why? What's going on? What's behind this? What's really happening? Next. In the hospital, 200 inpatients, 3/4 of patients that physicians should consider patients' spiritual needs. About 1/3 wanted their doctors to actually discuss religious beliefs, and about 1/2 wanted their doctors to pray with them. The one question I always ask every patient, so when I go out there, remember, I'm seeing them now, they're on hospice, they just got on hospice, they've been through a lot. They've been through multiple hospitalizations, some have been through radiation therapy, some have been through chemo. Most, regardless, have seen multiple physicians. And so at that point, they've suffered. I say, what's been your source of strength? I should have asked you guys before I put this up. But I said, what's been your source of strength? And again, transcending cultures, transcending economic things. Number one is almost always family. Number two is almost always faith. And number three is families. Now, if I have a patient who doesn't tell me faith or family or friends or has none of those, I know their death is going to be difficult. I know we're going to have problems. I know we're going to need a lot of support. When those three are intact, people do fairly well, whether I come and visit or hospice comes and visit or not. Now, people will tell me inner strength. I start to sweat. Because I know what happens is the inner strength, you know, I don't care how big your tree is, these diseases are like a gigantic axe. They start to chop at that tree. And no matter how strong you are, these diseases have a way of just chopping, 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 chopping. And those that are strong often will start to have this tree start to crumble. And those who say, I don't know, some will say, I just don't know. I just take a step every day or whatever. And those folks I worry about too because they don't know where to go. And so keep this in mind as we think about those that are dying. What was important to them? What is important to us who are living? It probably is the same three things. In female cancer patients, so faith was number two there and often number one. In a survey of 108 women undergoing treatment for gynecological cancer, 95% said religious involvement helped sustain their hopes. And of those, two-thirds said religion had a significant place. In other words, more people said it sustained their hopes than said it had a significant place. So we see this re-interest in religious things when people are seriously ill or dying. Next. At Duke University, 44% of patients said religious beliefs were the most important. It was number one way of handling with illness. Now they asked physicians, how do your patients cope with their illness? Only 9% of physicians said it was my patient's religious faith. In other words, physicians seem to be out of tune with how patients handle disease, how they handle illness, and how they handle dying. One thing that's important is to know that patients, I was giving a talk at Columbia. And I was at Columbia, and it was interesting. One of these older docs, really, you can tell, he had the bow tie, and he's been around medicine for years and years, you know, really refined, older guy, came up to me and said, you know, I heard your talk, and I haven't heard stories like you've heard told to me. I haven't had patients tell me those things. And I had to tell him, as kindly as I could, that probably he put a wall up. he was just saying there, I'm only your physician. I'm not here to relieve suffering. I'm here just to do medicine. Because what happens is patients won't voice these things unless they think someone is interested in listening to the other areas. And we often subconsciously, or in many ways, tell them what we want to hear or what we don't want to hear. And so getting beyond that, if we want to get to total suffering, we do it with our neighbors. We do it with people that we see at work. We don't want to go there because we don't know what it means getting into. So for me and for those in hospice, we have to triage suffering. We have to start. You start with physical pain. What Cicely Saunders found was that pain, this is what she calls it, pain nails you to your body. If you have pain, you hardly can do anything else. If you have pain and you're hurting, it's hard to pray. If you have pain and attorney, it's hard to go to your family and say certain things. It's hard to go anywhere. You're nailed to your body is what she said. And so what Cicely Saunders said, the job of medicine, the job of hospice, pull those nails out so the person can leave their body and do the other things. So I've had kidney stones. I've had 11 kidney stones. I've given birth to babies 11 times, you know? And if I come to your emergency room or I come to your place with kidney stone pain, do I want you to be asking a spiritual history? I want some pain relief. I'm rolling around in this, you know, bed with pain. And so we triage it this way. It's a very natural way to triage. It's also, I think, the way the church needs to go. You deal with people's physical needs, and then you go into different areas. On the other hand, you'll get surprised sometimes. I was making a visit, very difficult case, a lady who had been bouncing back and forth into our hospice unit. And I knew the case, although I hadn't seen the patient yet. Things eventually, the really tough ones eventually float up to me. I'm the senior medical director. And so the other doctors see them first, and when they really get things started, okay, let's get them in here. So I get out there, and I brought a PhD student, a pharmacy student, with me. And I said, this is going to be a great case. I know about this case. We're probably going to be doing some tricky stuff with the drug. So come on out, bring your calculator. You know, we'll see what happens. So we get out there, and I said to this patient, like I said to all my patients, I go, if I had a magic wand and I can't cure your cancer, what is your biggest problem right now? And I knew it was going to be pain. I mean, I've heard this from a million people. So I knew it was going to be pain. And she goes, she pauses, thinks, and says, I think I'm going to hell. That was it. After we picked ourselves off the floor and realized, okay, forget this triage thing. This is where the issue was. This is her source of suffering. This is why none of the pain medicines worked. This is why nothing we did worked up to that point. This was the point of suffering, the point that was sending her back to the inpatient unit and that was making things impossible, like in the Tolstoy novel, impossible, impossible to go on. So let me summarize for a second. So what I'm proposing to you and I'm trying to get you to buy into is that suffering is an integral part of the condition of being human. That suffering will occur in one or all the dimensions that we've mentioned, the social, the physical, the psychological, and the spiritual. And that if suffering has no spiritual meaning, all the stuff I'm talking about is a waste, and there's no spirituality of healthcare. You just got to admit it, forget it, and go there. However, again, I want to emphasize, even at major hospitals, spirituality is finding a way back because of this deep need. Question?
Yes.
Go ahead. I need a break.
I figured I would give your voice a break, too. I just had a question that sort of, I guess, relates, and I don't know, maybe you have heard of this as well, but I think sometimes in the Christian community you hear, or I have heard, that psychological suffering is oftentimes related to a spiritual suffering or a spiritual issue, that if someone has depression, then therefore they must have some sort of a spiritual thing going on in their lives, and how, I mean, I personally don't really hear that, so do you have any comments about that at all?
Yeah, I'm often not smart enough to figure that stuff out. And even though I've divided this thing into four very nice, convenient categories for you, those categories interlap and are so interwoven and so intricate that I sometimes can't tell physical pain from spiritual pain, from psychological pain, from emotional pain. And it's so entwined that, you know, it was Descartes who fouled everything up, you know what I mean? He got to the dualism where he split us up into this Cartesian dualism that there's bodies here, spirits here. And then we sort of have had a hard time ever thinking of ourselves as whole, that we're all these different pieces. It's so intricate that I think we do people a disservice to say depression is spiritual, depression is physical. often these things are so intertwined. And part of why I think this type of group is critical to continue, that if we can start integrating the knowledge of the clergy with the knowledge of the physicians, with the knowledge of the counselors, with the lay folks, and everybody starts thinking of people as whole human beings who are made in the image of God, and that they're suffering. And how can we all work together with our knowledge to put it together? And wouldn't that be cool? That's part of what I think this type of meeting group is about, of us integrating all the knowledge we have. Mine is very limited, being in the medical field. And other people may be limited other ways. But when we come together, we're the body of Christ. Thank you. Thanks for the break. Okay. Once you make those conclusions, you come to some wrong turns. The first wrong turn, I think, is physician-assisted suicide. Now, when I was the medical director of hospice, and I'll just pass it by you, before I came to New York, I was the medical director of the largest hospice in the country. It's also the hospice where Terry Schiavo was. So I had the experience of meeting Terry, examining her, and meeting her parents, everybody. So if you have questions about that case, I know all the players in that one can talk about it. But at this hospice, which had a daily census of about 1,800 patients, I would see any patient who requested physician-assisted suicide. Now, one of the weird things about being a hospice doctor is, you know, some people think you're Jack Kevorkian's cousin or something. So I'd come to the house, you know, ring the doorbell, and people would say, oh, come on in, we're glad you're here. Let's get this thing over with, you know. But what I would find is that as I would go out, and people would have the hemlock book at their bedside, and the nurse would say, Dr. Eber, we have a patient who asked us to end her life short. They asked for an overdose of medicine. So I'd make a visit. Because I was curious, why would someone want to do that? What makes a person want to cut their life short, even if it is only a few days or a few weeks or a few months? And as I started making visits and doing this, what I can tell you with confidence, it's never needed. Once you address the source of suffering, you know, when I first used to go out, I'd be like, oh, you know, is there any guns in the house? And then I started realizing, wait a minute, all this is these people are telling us they're suffering. That's all it means. They're suffering. And my goal is like a surgeon, but without a knife, maybe the knife of words, I try to dig and say, what makes them feel this way? Where's the suffering? Is it spiritual? Is it physical? Is it psychological? And you start to dig down and see where it is. And once I found this, once I addressed it, as far as I know, you know, I didn't see every patient back, but as far as I know, from my nurses and from follow-up, every patient was glad they didn't go that route. Now look at Jack Kevorkian. I hate to even go there, but this guy's a pathologist. You know, what does he know about suffering? My guess is he's probably a decent guy who just is, in a sense, over his head. In other words, let me show you what I mean. Look at their study in the Annals of Internal Medicine. A doctor who has good end-of-life training says, I don't need physician-assisted suicide. A doctor with poor end-of-life training, meaning doesn't understand the things I'm telling you about suffering and such, says, I need it. Do you get the point? Like, if they don't have the tools, let me give an example. I can't fix anything in our house. Nothing. My son will tell you. My wife can fix more things in our house than I can fix, okay? Now, so I have two left hands. Now, imagine I'm going to do bypass surgery on you. Okay, so I get you on the table, right? And I'm sure I could cut through some of the arteries and, you know, get me through the chest and open the ribs a little bit. But at some point in that surgery, I have to find the internal mammary artery. You know, and I didn't do very good in gross anatomy, so it's unlikely. And then if I do find that artery, I got to tie this artery onto your heart, knowing I can barely get my shoelace tied, right? At some point in that surgery, I'm going to be over my head. And the compassionate thing to do is give you an overdose of morphine and call it there. That's the compassionate thing to do. That's what happens to some docs. If they don't know how to treat something, how to do something, they're over their head and they think they need this tool. What they need is other people to come alongside them and help them with the spiritual suffering of the patient, or the psychological, or the emotional, and to recognize that they need help, or call a hospice in, or call a hospice doctor. So that's part of the issue, I think, on physician-assisted suicide. Notice this study, the Netherlands. Remember, it's legal in the Netherlands to have euthanasia. You can end your life short with a lethal injection if you're less than 6 months. And well, why would people do that? Well, that's what they asked. And these are people who actually went ahead and did it. Obviously, this study was done before that happens. In the Netherlands, only 5% said physical pain. Now, most people, before this study was done, thought, well, that's the reason. That's what you sort of read in the New York Times. The poor guy's having so much pain. You wouldn't treat your dog this way. Give us a break, you know? But what we find is the number one reason? Hopelessness. Now, where is hopeless for a person who wants to divide? Is it spiritual? Is it physical? Is it emotional? Is it psychological? Yes, 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 yes. The other thing you can do is you can say that relief of suffering is the ultimate goal. That's the only thing that matters, is to relieve suffering. And Eric Cassell, in his book, The Nature of Suffering, which is a great book, by the way, and I'm using his quote to prove my point, but he doesn't do it in the book, so don't misquote. That's a great book, and if you want to read a book about suffering, Eric Cassell was right on. He's from Cornell. Notice what he said is, he goes, and I'll tell you about this book in a second. As technology went up, he said, if technology is going up in medicine, shouldn't patient satisfaction go up? Instead, technology goes up, patient satisfaction went down. What happened? These claims, we forgot about suffering. We just got into a technical mode, or we're good technicians. But if you think relief of suffering is the ultimate thing, then you start doing things that breaks various other barriers. For those who are believers here, remember how Christ summed up the law? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself, right? What comes first? Not loving your neighbor first. If you love your neighbor, you say, well, I don't want to live that way. I'd want to be dead. But we have to honor God first and do whatever is within those limits. That's why I would say the same limits are here. Given that we're honoring God, we relieve suffering as much as we can. Wrong turns, immortality. I actually heard a guy giving a talk. After I finished, I gave the talk. He came up after, and he said, you know, I'm not going to have to worry about any of this stuff. I think none of us are going to die. He was about in his 40s. He goes, I think we're going to solve this problem. And, you know, with all the stem cells, and we're going to get new cells coming in. And he goes, I think this whole problem is over. I said, well, which problem? We're talking about suffering. He goes, well, the physical problem. Well, how about the rest of it? That could be, in a sense, worse. Live with all your other sufferings forever, you know? So the call of the healthcare professional is a noble one. Relieve suffering, be a healer, and comfort the sick and dying. For those in the healthcare profession, we forget these things. I have to remind myself about this like once a week, because you get stuck in the paperwork, you get stuck in the mess of everything, and you forget what you're there for. So those who are physicians and nurses, remind yourself about this frequently. Review what you're there for, who you are, what you're doing. I redefined it for this talk, and I said, well, what is the Christian nobleman? Is it any different? Does it change? Well, I thought it was pretty much the same, except while living a life of faith, hope, and love. And I'm going to take those three words, and I'm going to run from there with those. From 1 Corinthians, of course, these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. Okay, let's talk about faith for a second. Yes, we have to define things. It's more than creeds. For me, it's really about trust. When I'm making visits, I'm thinking, does this patient have faith? Is this a person whose faith is weakened, has no faith, has a lot of faith? And for me, the key word seems to be, when I'm trying to interpret that, is trust. Faith, in a sense, is, do they trust God that various things, that he has a universal concern? That's what I have to believe. You know, I make visits in some pretty bad places sometimes. And, you know, I have to convince myself that this guy was made in the image of God. I don't see it sometimes. You know, I have to sort of talk myself to realize that's his truth. That's a truth that's there regardless of whether I feel like it or I see any evidence of that. That that's a fundamental truth. That God is love. That every patient is eternal. That every patient is made in the image of God. And I have to remind myself about that before every visit. So when a patient has no faith, this is what I would propose to you. That the Christian clinician, and notice how I put this, through subtle gestures and words. I'm going to pop a candy here for a second. Any comments at this point? Brings a shared understanding about the brokenness. We're all broken. We're all just not right. You know? The world is broken. Things just aren't the way they should be. And that automatically should connect you with other folks. The perceptives of eternity. When you show a person that they are valuable, how do you show that? You show it by how you examine the patient. If you're late, how you go in. How you treat them. You know, when I have my kidney stones, you know, people come and they give the food tray. Some people throw it at you, you know. Other people put it out and open it up for you. You know, the difference between these really expensive restaurants in Manhattan and the decent ones, I don't think it's the food. I think it's the service, the way it's prepared. And in a sense, that's what in medicine and how we treat our neighbors. It's how is always showing dignity at that point. It's how we do it, not often what we're doing. And then the awareness that there's the possibility of redemption. That this person has the potential. Not that he's an award to be won or a trophy to be captured, you know, that he'll get saved. But rather there's a possibility of redemption from this. If he doesn't know Christ, this suffering isn't meaningless in many ways. But it can have meaning. It can have purpose. And it's all subtle gestures. It's how it's done, how it's mentioned, how it's said. And when patients have true faith, they will encourage their caregivers. You know, I've had this nasty cold on and off since January. And I'm a lung doctor. Isn't that embarrassing? You know, I'm coughing, I'm hacking. You know, people say, see a good doctor, yeah, you know. And I had a patient. Her name was Marie Zeno. This is in Florida. She was my patient for 14 years. Marie never went a day without coughing, hacking, bringing up mucus. She was injured. Strange story. She was at a hairspray factory, making hairspray. And this hairspray caused some of the workers where it was developed to develop permanent chronic asthma and bronchitis. Marie was in the hospital 1 week out of every month getting steroids, IV medicines. I myself had to intubate her 3 or 4 times. And so here I am, you know, coughing at night. I'm not getting much sleep these days. My, you know, wife's up and I'm coughing and hacking and breathing. And you know what came to my mind was the faith of Marie Zeno. She was a strong believer who, despite all this, never complained, came to my office, and this was a source of true strength for me. Marie did it for 14 years. I can't do this for 4 months, you know? And when I've met people who have faith, who are believers, it has so encouraged me. What I've seen in them is they have hope that transcends sorrow. They have trust that even though the questions are not answered, I mean, I can't answer the question, why would a 36-year-old have terminal cancer? I mean, I don't know the answer. Why would a breast cancer, why would a lady with 3 kids, you know, who was in her young 30s, leave 3 kids with breast cancer? I don't know. But some of these, they have the trust. No answers to the questions, but they trust. And they have an eternal perspective. And when you meet people like this, and I do, they change me. They make me different. I can see this. And I think they have a better testimony than me because they've suffered. They've gone through it. And so when a patient has faith, it ripples out. I used to have a house in Florida. I was on a lake, and we had grapefruit trees. I planted all these grapefruit trees. And I didn't know you get so many, you know, so we had tons. And every once in a while, you know, you're out there, and you sort of you throw them into the middle of the lake, and you watch the thing ripple out. People who have true faith, sick or not sick, but particularly when they're ill, it's like a rippling effect. It goes out from them to their families, to the hospital, to the physicians, to the nurses, to the physical therapists, to the respiratory therapists, to the dietitians, and it ripples out in many ways. When faith collapses in the face of illness, it does. People are embarrassed. Their faith is gone. Remember I mentioned the axe chopping at the tree. What I have found is that I had a patient just recently, I'll tell you this story. I'm seeing this patient, and I always say, has faith been an important part of your life? And she goes, well, it was. Well, what happened? Well, I got sick. And God was going to heal me, and now I'm dying. I see. So you feel alone? He's left me. And you know, and it hit me suddenly. This lady was up in, way up there, Inwood. And I'm up there seeing her. And I said, you know, I said, I'm a believer too. I said, what do you think the odds are in New York City of a believer who's a physician visiting another believer in this city? I go, you know, maybe God's not as far away as you think. So sometimes we as believers, and you know, her eyes lit up. And she thought for the first time, could God maybe not have forgotten me? Could it be that one person who he sends in this 9 million people, you know, city is a believer? So I think the thing for us to do also is understand how vulnerable we are. Any one of us given the right buttons, the right disease, may have our faith start to crumble. I'd like to think not. I'd like to think, regardless of what happens, I would be, you know, this great Christian. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. And so if we can get to that point where we're vulnerable and realize, wow, this is hard stuff, and understand how deeply this has affected the person, and we can be a conduit then for God's mercy, for his forgiveness, for his love. Now, when the clinician has no faith, now, when I put this slide up, I put the probable in there. I thought it was too strong. For those people who are here who are non-believers, who are good doctors and good nurses, you know, I think he says if you don't have faith, you're just applying dry bandages, but you never truly heal. And, you know, there might be something to that. I don't think it's as strong as Daniel Somovsky, but I think there's evidence to that. That I think the best healers are going to be people who are believers. When you have this whole dimension thought, and you think of people as made in the image of God, how could you not, in my view, be more of a believer? But notice how he put on those that fill themselves with superficial pleasures. He's sort of emphasizing the superficiality. And could they really help a person who's suffering? And maybe he has something to say there. Maybe the answer is no. Okay, good. This is class participation time. I get a break. The next two slides are clue slides. These are clues for you. Václav Havel, you know the story. Václav Havel, the former president of Czechoslovakia. Well, he was a poet, and now he's in jail. Okay? And he's in jail under the Soviet domination, and he writes letters to his wife. And these letters get smuggled out of jail. Letter, and it's published, it's called Letters to Olga. And at this point, he's in jail for about 12 years. And it looks like the Soviet Union's never going to collapse, and he's going to be there forever. And he writes to his wife, and I'm sure he said, "Dear Olga, your hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out." Okay, think about that. I wrote an article that was picked up by MedScrib a couple years ago on hope. And what I proposed was, and I'll show you how I got to this point, that there's three stages of hope. There's hope for a cure, hope to live a little longer, and the hopes of a dying. Well, this reminds me. If you're looking at your notes now, do not look down. The answers are in the notes. Don't look at your notes. What happened was, I'm on hospice, okay? And I read this study, which was very interesting, and it showed that people on hospice, there's something called hope sticks. You can quantify hope. And people who come on hospice, their hope is pretty low, right? And after a week, it goes even lower. And the longer they stay on hospice, their hope goes up, 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 up. Now, as a physician, I'm thinking, their hope goes up on hospice? Why would that be? So I had to come with some conclusion. So I said, well, there's hope for a cure. There's hope a little longer. So I had to say that hope can be changed then, redefined, refocused. This is the patient who helped me. And this is where I need your help. I went to see this patient. He's about 50 years old. He has pancreatic cancer, a very rapid, fast-going cancer. When I saw him, he weighed 70 pounds. He was normally 150. And he could barely get from his bed to the bedside commode. And he was sent home to hospice from a cancer center, saying that there was nothing, no other treatment. So I said to him, like I say to all my patients, what are your hopes at this stage of your disease? And he says to me, well, my hopes are in you guys. I said, you guys? What do you mean, you guys? He goes, well, my hopes were in you guys, the medical profession. And I'm like, totally puzzled. I figure the guy's got 2 to 3 weeks left to live, maybe a month at best. I go, what do you mean your hopes were in the medical profession? He goes, every day, open the newspaper, looking to see if there's a cure for pancreatic cancer. So where's his hopes? He's stuck on hope for a cure, isn't he? Now, I left that place puzzled. Because was that reasonable? This was irrational. This was unbelievably irrational. He was not getting any medicine. He was sent home from the place. He weighed 70 pounds. I mean, a 12-year-old kid would know there's no cure here. There's no possibility of a cure. And here's an intelligent, very intelligent, he was a lawyer, in fact, very intelligent man telling me he's looking for a cure. So my question for you is, this is what I had to ponder when I went home that night. What hopes can you give this guy? What hopes can we in the medical profession, or anybody, if you're his neighbor, What hopes can you give a 50-year-old who's got pancreatic cancer, who's got a couple weeks left to live? Just yell it out.
Hereafter.
Ah. So there's the spiritual hopes that if he has faith, there's going to be a hereafter. He's going to see his God, his Savior. Good. What are the hopes?
To reconcile, to use each day as an opportunity for...
I had a patient, just recently, I said, I had a magic wand. Like I always say that, I love that question. And what's the one thing that bothers you the most? What can I help you with? She said, I haven't talked to my daughter in 10 years. Do you want me to give her a call? Would you? Sure. The hope of reconciliation. What are the hopes? Thank you. What other hopes can we give this guy? Yeah.
From a faith perspective, that life itself, your life has had and has meaning in the eyes of God.
That the life had meaning or purpose. Exactly. And that how do we help people do that? How can you help people do that? Let's say your neighbor is a Christian and he has cancer. He's got 2 or 3 weeks left to live. You do life for you. Tell me about your life. What did you learn during your life? Tell me about your children. Tell me about your job. Tell me about the things you did. And you start seeing life for you. That's what we do at hospice. Our volunteers go in when they journal. As you get people, you try to help them see the meaning. Very often, especially for believers, there's going to be a meaning. You just got to go and dig and ask questions and find out the threads of where it was. Thank you. What else? It's a real spiritual group here. Yes?
The reality that life is terminal and that how we lived, the satisfaction of his having lived a life to serve humanity as a warrior or something like that.
So looking for the good things that he did. And that gives meaning and purpose again. What other hopes can this guy have?
His prayer might not just be for himself either, so it might be even after his life has ended that eventually there will be a cure.
So maybe his experience, his time at the hospital might have helped other people to be cured. This guy particularly was at an experimental program at the end, so maybe his would be better for good. What else? We're missing some biggies here. I mean, big ones. The elephant in the room. Yes.
I think there's the hope that you're going to treat somebody with dignity and that you'll share with them in their suffering, whether it's physical or whatever, but that you'll be with them.
Treat with dignity. What does that mean? Hope that he could be treated with dignity. That's out there. That word dignity is used in many ways. Death with Dignity is the name of an organization that's a proponent for euthanasia. So what do you mean by euthanasia. What did you mean by dignity?
I didn't mean euthanasia, but I guess it's not something you see much in hospice, but inpatient, we often are working to do heroic efforts to keep people alive, knowing that they're not going to work. So I think that we dehumanize people when we pretend we do all kinds of invasive things and poke and prod.
So she said, if you do a lot of stuff in the hospital, you dehumanize them, but I'll help you. I think what it means is to honor a person's wishes. How do you want to be treated? How would you want us to treat you once you can't make decisions? For this guy, do you want to go back to the hospital? Do you want to stay at home? Those kind of things. Yes?
Well, I think you mentioned that he's a lawyer, and lawyers usually go into a courtroom to solve a problem, or people come to a lawyer and think, if I have a lawyer, this thing's going to get solved right. So he comes to you with professional courtesy, as it were. And it seems like very naive, but it almost seems like he's like a super believer or something, or he's a very naive. I don't know if he's a believer or not, but if he was a believer, it seems like, in other words, he is really expecting a miracle in 3 weeks. That's what he's really looking for. He's looking for something so miraculous that within 3 weeks, not only will he get the treatment, but it would be the road to recovery.
You would think so, but that's not the issue. We've missed it still. What's one of the biggest hopes? Okay, I'll tell you. Well, now we'll get the other ones. I didn't know this after 14 years of private practice, so how would you guys know? But I didn't know that every 98% of your patients with cancer think they're going to die screaming in pain. In other words, I didn't know that because the facts are 50% die with minimal pain. They just stop eating, they dwindle away, they sort of just go. And then the other 50%, I can control their pain adequately at home with my bag of tricks in 95% of the cases. But let's say you think you're going to die screaming in pain like he did. He could not go anywhere. He wasn't actually looking for a miracle. He just did not have the tools, the coping mechanisms, to face what he knew was the future. In other words, when I told him this stuff, these numbers, and I said, and in fact, he was jaundiced and he wasn't having much pain. The fact is, he wasn't going to have much pain. I knew that, just from the natural history. It was like somebody put a knife into this big inflated balloon of anxiety. It was like, whoosh. Now we can go on. Now we can start to face things. Because that thing was so big, he just couldn't go there. He couldn't imagine that he was going to be screaming in that. So one of the hopes is the hope that you won't be in severe pain. The hope that you'll be fairly comfortable. And every group I've been in, except this group, mentions that pretty much first. You're also spiritual. We forgot about the pain. That was a big issue, though. Now, I didn't know that. After all, no one taught me that in medical school. No one taught me that patients have these fears. And you realize the disconnect often between the physician and what the patient is thinking or feeling. Well, let's go on. What other hopes can we give this guy? Yes, in the back.
The people he loves are going to be cared for, whether it's a spouse or...
The people he loves are going to be cared for. And so in hospice, we talk about bereavement. This is the kind of thing I think churches should be doing. We follow up with calls every month for 13 months. How are you doing? How are things going? Offer bereavement classes. Redeemer's so good about classes and getting things done. But that's an important part. And if they know, you know, my wife's going to go back to the church and be with that bereavement group, how reassuring. They feel that way about hospice. Let me tell you some of the other hopes. These are ones that I came up with. When I see patients, I give them homework. And I joke with them. And I say, look, I give my kids homework. Just because you're dying doesn't mean you don't get homework. You're getting homework. And this is your homework. I want you to give and accept love to your wife and kids. Particularly men, I do this too. Because what happens is when men are, they show love by, you know, bringing home a paycheck, by cutting the lawn, washing the car, and now they're stuck in their bed. So I give them homework. I say, I'm coming back in a week. I want to see how you do, and I want you to work on this. Hope that a person can find forgiveness. This was it's a universal thing that's major. Any one of your patients who's dying or seriously ill is thinking about this. I'll tell you another story. The voice holds out here. I had a patient who had emphysema, and I'm a pulmonologist. And I was in private practice, and he was a patient of mine, and we were very close, and he even bought us a couple antique clocks at garage sales. He would, like, pick these up for me, and he occasionally fix them. Anyway, I leave my practice, and I go full-time hospice. And then he comes on hospice because now he's dying. And it's the worst case possible. He is short of breath. Nothing helps. He won't sleep at night, and his wife won't sleep at night. He's anxious during the day. He's agitated. He's going back and forth into the hospital. Those in the pulmonary field and know medicine know how emphysema patients can be. This was the worst of them all. So I'm at his house, and I'm making a visit. Him and his wife are sitting there. And I said sort of out of the way, oh, this is so frustrating. I go, I know you. Everybody is just... I said, tell me, is there anything that's bothering you? Is there anything that keeps you up at night? And he kicks his wife out of the room. And they were always together, and they were always very close. So I was like, well, maybe I'm onto something here. And he says, Dr. Avery, he goes, I gotta tell you a story I've never told anybody. He goes, 50 years ago in World War II, on an island in the South Pacific, he goes, there was hand-to-hand combat. Some of my buddies had died. And I was making patrol. He goes, and I came around the corner with my Jeep. Over the hill came 30 Japanese. Guns up, white flag. And he goes, I took my machine gun out, and I mowed them all down. And I never told a soul. And that was, that was a big thing to tell me. And I blundered completely, like I always do in the big moments, you know. And I said, well, you know, you were young. Forget about it. I didn't know what to say, And I said, well, it was war. I mean, things happened. I really just didn't know where to go. But he was more heroic than me. And he said, no, he goes, I'm a murderer. And I realized he was right. Now, this guy And we started talking. And it took us some time to get to places, but he had faith, and this faith had been for 50 years just attacked by this thing. Attacked. I mean, in a vicious, violent way, where by the time we saw him, there was nothing left, I don't think, at all, except this poor guy who was absolutely going into what we call terminal restlessness or agitation. And it was very interesting. We called this pastor. We prayed with him. And this guy was able to find complete forgiveness. He told his wife. It was hugging. He died on minimal morphine and minimal Ativan. But the most amazing thing was this. He asked me to come to his house before he died. He asked me to come to his house and said, I want to tell my boys what I did. And he said, can you come and be there? So I came to the house. He had two boys. And here he is telling his kids what he did. And the kids saying, Dad, we forgive you. And there was hugging. And there's complete forgiveness. And he died. You know, a couple weeks later. And you realize that is what all of us need. This was dramatic. I don't know if I'll ever hear a story like that again. But I need forgiveness. There are things I say that I shouldn't say. Things that I do that I shouldn't do. Things I should do that I don't do. And each one of us needs forgiveness. And you realize that's what he taught me. That all of us need to say that. Please forgive me and I forgive you so quickly. So what I've done is when I see patients, I now have a prescription pad that I write down. I write down to my patients, this is more homework for you. 5 things I want you to say to loved ones and to God. Please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. I love you. And goodbye. And what happens is folks will say that. Well, I was out seeing a patient, and this guy was one of these ones where he had an attitude, or I had an attitude. I'm not sure who had. Somebody had an attitude. Okay? And he's in his 30s, late 30s, and he's dying of alcoholic liver disease and hepatitis and drug abuse and basically any possible bad choice he made. Okay? That's sort of the way his life went. And so I gave him this prescription like I give to everybody. It's sort of like a habit now. I just do it routinely. But I had a bad attitude. I gave it to him and said, he'll never use this. I'm wasting my breath, wasting my time. But I gave it to him. A couple weeks later, his mom calls me and says, Dr. Avery, I'm not sure what you did during your visit. He said, but the first time ever, my son said, please forgive me, Mom, and I love you. And you realize that is heroic. This guy was more heroic than I'll ever be. This guy was more heroic than people who live a good life. He was able to go there and do that. And you realize how Christian that is? How the values of Christ are in those kind of things. The other hopes of the dying, that death won't be alone. Our dream at hospice, what's our goal at V&S Hospice? This is pretty cool. This is why I do what I do, why I love what I do. That no one in New York City would die alone or in pain. I mean, isn't that cool? Can you imagine that? If no one in New York City would die alone or in pain, how great that would be. That's my dream. Well, I'd want to see hospice grow. Reconciliation, next slide. Getting affairs in order, transmitting knowledge, spiritual hopes, next slide. You mentioned most of these. You guys were good at that. Most of the time the medical meetings, I have this slide. I use these at medical meetings. Medical meetings, this slide, no one ever gets these. I have to go through these with them. You guys use the opposite. Next. Okay, faith, hope, and now the last one is love. You can look at your notes, yeah. All the answers are there. Okay, for love, there's different ways to look at people who are suffering. One is sympathy. You're distressed by the suffering of others. It's nice. You know, you sort of feel sorry for somebody, and that can lead to good acts sometimes. Then there's empathy, a genuine attempt to understand a person. Understand their suffering as they understand it. Not to say, well, if I had this, I would do this, but if I was in that person's shoes, if I was that person, how would I respond, or how are they responding? What do I feel? But the last one is the one that I like the most, true compassion. And I honestly believe this, that very few, I don't know, I haven't thought about this deep enough, but I'm going to say it. I think that if you're not a believer, you may not be able to go there, which is the compassion, which is really to love, in a sense, the patient. You know, compassion means co-patria, to co-suffer with, to go there with the person, and to take on some of the sufferings of the patient. Now, if you're seeing 20 patients in your office, can you do that on a daily basis? Definitely not. But are there those occasional patients where we can do it, but we don't? Or those patients who need it, and we don't? When it isn't really that much time or that much effort. We mentioned that about soul pain is by the way it's done. Daniel Slomowski said a quiet smile, a gentle touch, if done in Jesus, maybe all that's required to communicate these gifts, to show this. It doesn't take a sermon. It takes just being there, knowing they can trust you, and saying things kindly. Oh, I had these, in case you wanted those five things. Again, I should say this did not come from me. You know who wrote these? A Jewish hospice doctor in Montana. He came up with these five things that he felt were critical for people who are at the end of life. Ira Byock. He wrote a wonderful book called Dying Well. I've learned so much from him, and he learned it just from listening to his patients. He has a new book out, I think, called The Four Things That Matter, that he took from this. Next. Okay, conclusions. Three conclusions I came up with. The gospel's answer to suffering and death is found in Christ Jesus. And number two, to the extent that we understand really what Christ did, really understand and appropriate it into our being, I think to that extent we'll be able to understand suffering. Now, that's a mystery. That's a confusing sentence. I know it doesn't make sense in some ways, but I think it's the closest we get to understanding this. These things, do I understand? How much have I appropriated Christ's death? What it really means to me. That's what Tim talks about every week. You know, I think to the same extent, I'll begin to understand the sufferings of myself and others. Second one, be courageous. I'm convinced that doing this kind of stuff that we're talking about doesn't take theology, doesn't take knowledge, doesn't take intelligence, doesn't take, eloquence, whatever you want to say. It takes courage. Courage is the key element to say, I want to be a different person. I want to go there. I'm going to follow in the steps that Christ gave. And I think a couple of quotes, why spend your money for what is not bread for wages but fails to satisfy, from Isaiah. In other words, and from Blaise Pascal, if God is God, then he's the most important thing there is. I mean, when you get to that point, those issues, you start realizing, wow, this really, in a sense, is where it's at. And for me, doing hospice has changed me in a dramatic way. Because as you work with patients who are dying, I learn things. I'll give you two examples. I had a patient she had breast cancer in her 30s, and back then she went through the bone marrow transplant. I mean, she fought to the nth degree. She died in her late 30s. But on her deathbed, when I was there a couple days before, she told me, Dr. Avery, if I could bottle what I learned from this cancer and give it to people who don't have cancer, it would be the most valuable gift I could give them. I thought, oh, that's pretty cool and well said, you know, and I left. But then I realized, wow, I had the chance to hear and to listen to people who are telling me those things. What a privilege. For us in the medical profession, for those of us who are pastors, for those who confide in us, who are counselors, that we get a chance to peek into this and to hear those precious things. And then when I did my training at Northwestern, there was a doctor in Chicago named Roger Bone. If you're at all involved in critical care or pulmonary medicine, you know Roger Bone, very famous. Well, anyway, he diagnoses himself in the mid-50s with cancer. And he tells the story, and he died soon thereafter. But he tells the story how he lived on this house in Chicago, on the river. And he was a typical workaholic, probably a typical, this is Chicago, but it's New York, Chicago, so all this thing, working these long hours. And now he's dying, and he says for the first time he noticed the sunset behind his house over the river. Never noticed it all those years living there. And he said what happened was, every night him and his wife would walk, go to the first floor and watch the sunset. And they would go to the second floor and watch the sunset again. And they would go to the third floor and watch the sunset again. And you know, for me, I could never see a sunset the same again because of these things the patients have taught. And I would say, as you start to go into this suffering of patients, yes, there'll be some suffering for yourself. You'll be doing some of that. But the richness and the depth of things that you'll experience and the lessons far outweighs the negative things. And so I think as believers, as non-believers, as healthcare professionals, I think that's how we want to live our life, in a courageous way, in a more in-depth way. Thank you.